Welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. One of the questions we've been asking since we started this show is simple. Why do we continue to have such high drowning rates despite all the information available to the public? For decades, water safety has focused on warnings. We put up signs, we issue advisories, we tell people about rip currents, dangerous surf, and changing ocean conditions. Yet the numbers remain stubbornly high. So perhaps we're asking the wrong question. Instead of asking, how do we warn people, maybe we should be asking, how do we prepare people? Warnings tell people what might happen. Preparations teach people what to do when it happens. That shift in thinking is at the heart of today's conversation. We're joined by Dr. Will Kuhn, a leading researcher examining coastal drowning and drowning prevention. Originally from California, Will has worked as a beach lifeguard, completed his doctoral research at the University of New South Wales in Australia, and now serves as the National Manager of Drowning Prevention Strategy for the Royal Lifesaving Australia. His research has focused on understanding why people drown, how coastal risks are managed, and what prevention strategies are most effective. He recently presented to the Hawaii Water Safety Task Force, challenging us to think differently about drowning prevention by looking beyond individual incidents and focusing on data, risk factors, and systems that influence safety outcomes. Today, we'll explore an important question for Hawaii. Why are people still drowning, and what can we do differently to save lives? Will, welcome to Deep Dive in Water Safety. I kind of put you on the spotlight with all that, but I just think it's really important for people to understand what you've been doing. And I was there at the Hawaii Water Safety Task Force conference and when you presented. And I have a bunch of questions of which I said I could talk to you for hours, but we just want to get information out to people. So we're going to start with data and drowning trends, then segmentation and risk, which you talked a lot about. The systems in public health, and then maybe we can move into swimming water competency, rip currents, and then basically what you think we should be doing, lifeguards, water safety, and future solutions. That's a lot.
Sounds
So,
fun. Let's do
okay, so
it.
let's do it. Your study was coastal drowning, a scoping review of burden risk factors and prevention strategies that you're on in 2021 with Jazz Laws. Rob Brander, who I both had on the show, and Amy Pendon. Okay, so where do you want to start? When you looked at
Well,
Hawaii's drowning data, what jumped out at you? Are we measuring the right things? Are we missing part of the story? What information do you wish Hawaii had that would help them explain why people drown? And what surprised you the most from your presentation to the Hawaii Task Force? That's a lot, but.
that is a lot. So I love starting with data. I am a self-proclaimed data nerd, and I really spend a lot of time thinking about numbers and doing analysis and working with lots of really wonderful people who are thinking about these things as well. So when we look at the drowning data generally, well, let's just start with this. Most of the time when we're talking about drowning data, we're usually talking about deaths. And I think it's really important to start with this kind of just really clear statement that, drowning affects not only the individual, but it also affects families and it affects rescuers. And oftentimes people have a submersion incident, a drowning event, and they live, right? That's called a non-fatal drowning event. And the range of outcomes on the other end of a non-fatal drowning incident could be as minor as a visit to the emergency department or the hospital, and then they go home and they're fine. And it could be as catastrophic as someone who has lifelong neurological deficits, based on a submersion event when they're a child. So, I think it's important to remember that, I'll talk a little bit about the fatal drowning numbers. But it's just important for everyone to remember that there's a times, there's a three times or a four times, or in some cases in like for children, it's as high as 9 or 10 times the number of events that are non-fatal. So When we look at Hawaii, Hawaii has the second highest drowning rate of any US state. That's just after Alaska, at about 3.2 per 100,000, which is very high. That's the drowning rate in Australia is about 1 per 100,000. And that's just of residents, right? And so when you said what's one of the things that sticks out when I look at the drowning statistics from Hawaii, the first one, which probably won't be a surprise to your listeners, is just the sheer number of tourists that are dying from drowning on the island. So according to the Hawaii Water Safety Plan, that number is about 50%. Is that right, Murat? Yeah, about half.
Yeah, at least.
At
Well,
least,
not
yeah.
yet. And then 90% of them from snorkeling. So that's a whole
Yeah,
different
that's
topic.
right. So that was going to be the other thing, right? So I think the first thing that really jumped out at me was, and this is a data problem as well, because oftentimes we don't only talk in numbers, we talk in rates, right? Because rates are a little bit easier to compare, and in order to do a rate, you have you have to know how many people are exposed, and so normally we just use resident rates, but you can't really do that in Hawaii because there's so many tourists that are getting into trouble, and so you kind of have to do some interesting and funky math to get a better a picture of that. So just to compare to some other countries that have really high, let's call it like marine tourism economies. So like Greece, about a third of the drowning deaths were tourists. Spain, about 20%. Costa Rica, about 38%. All of those are much lower than 50% in Hawaii. In Australia, we have a huge marine visitor economy as well. And our coastal drowning rate for visitors is about 13%, right? So that means that eight Australians drown for every single tourist. And so there's a bit of myth busting that happens when you look at those numbers. So, I think for me, one of the really interesting things to think about in what can happen in Hawaii is how do we effectively address this problem with tourists getting into trouble and the risks that are in that space.
So you went on to talk about how we do this, and you think segmentation is important. Can you talk about that? When we talk about drowning statistics, you just said that we lump everyone together, but it's important to understand who is drowning, under what circumstances, and whether different groups require different prevention approaches. We spend a lot of time talking about visitor drownings. What do the data actually tell us about visitors compared to residents? And what groups have the highest risk? And when you look at our data, where do you see the biggest opportunity to reduce drowning deaths? That's a
So
lot.
this word, yeah, that is a lot. So this word segmentation is an interesting one, and what that basically acknowledges is that people are not the same. So oftentimes in health, public health, when we're trying to address a certain problem, we'll identify a group that is particularly vulnerable or particularly high risk for whatever the outcome is. So in this case, we're interested in tourists who are drowning in Hawaii. Now, we need to start by recognizing that not all tourists are the same, right? Tourists are not one big blob, just like, young males are not all the same, or older adults are not all the same, or men are not all the same, right? And so one of the really important things that I think is a potentially a data opportunity here is to do a little bit of a deep dive on the different sort of risk profiles, right? The 18, 19, 20 something visitor to Hawaii who is hiking and seeking out remote waterfalls and, on the Nepali coast trying to find really remote beaches by themselves. That is a very different person than the couple from Texas who's celebrating their retirement, age 65, been eating cheeseburgers for their whole life. Right. Like it's a very different profile. So I think it's important to think about the fact that people are different. And then the second thing is trying to understand how does the visitor profile differ from the resident profile, right? And the Hawaii Water Safety Plan does a pretty good job of outlining the first step of that. You mentioned it earlier, Margaret, like snorkeling deaths are a really good example. Over 90% of the drowning deaths that are occurring when people are snorkeling are tourists,
Right.
right? On the flip side of that, almost all the drowning deaths of people who are free diving are not tourists. Those are Hawaii residents. And so
Right.
that's, you know, we can start to paint this picture, which then helps us go to the next phase, which is, okay, what can we do about it? One of the, you know, challenges when we do look at drowning data is very often it is difficult to get information on the circumstances of the drowning death. And so, you know, we can gather this sometimes from lifeguard reports, or, you know, maybe the paramedic wrote up a narrative, or maybe the police officer who was on scene wrote up a narrative. There might be information in the media, but in a data system sense, that requires somebody pulling all that stuff together. It requires somebody reviewing it. That's time, that's energy, that's money. And so, you know, oftentimes we don't have all the information. Now, from my perspective, you know, the Hawaii Department of Public Health has been one of the leaders in this space, actually. When you look at what other states have not done, they don't have this level of detail. And there's some really exciting work you know, about to kick off, which will improve the data picture even more. So again, I think segmentation is really important, understanding that not all tourists are the same. The second one is trying to figure out and build a little bit of a profile of the circumstances with an asterisk can be very difficult with limited data.
Okay, so this is gonna build into messaging down the road here when we talk about segmentation, but you also talked
So
about
is it? I might just question that. Is it always going to lead to messaging? Is it always going to lead to education? Right? I
I don't know.
feel like, you know, oftentimes in water safety and in drowning prevention, education is the first stop, right? And there's a lot of reasons for that, but we're very quick to think we just need to educate these people.
Right.
And in other domains and other parts of health, and even in water safety to an extent, we are seeing the evidence indicate that awareness alone, knowledge alone, does not equal behavior change. And we fall into this trap of only they knew that there was a rip there, they wouldn't have gone in. If only they knew that that, you know, beach wasn't lifeguarded, they wouldn't have gone there. If only they knew X, if only they knew Y. And while it makes sense logically, the evidence doesn't su really support that conclusion fully.
Okay, so that moves into systems, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So there's a systems question
So
here,
tell
but
me what we're going
yeah.
to do, Dr. Will Coon, because.
Okay. So, you know, let's stick on the tourist one for a minute, because I think that there's some really interesting things that could happen in this space, and there's some examples from other locations around. So in Australia, we have the Great Barrier Reef. We've got a huge dive and snorkel industry that caters towards all stripes of tourists. And there are incidents that happen, you know, with visitors, international visitors who are snorkeling, but they're pretty rare. And one of the things, again, causation does not. Correlation does not equal causation, but one of the things that has really, you know, been strong here in Australia, especially in Queensland, in the Australian state of Queensland, are medical assessments. These are self-medical assessments for tourists who are participating in activities. So when my partner and I went up to scuba dive on the Great Barrier Reef, when we signed up for the scuba with the scuba company, there was this big long checklist that we had to do that was a self-proclaimed, you know, are you on any medications? Have you had any hospitalizations? All this sort of stuff. And so that entire initiative was co-developed, co-designed with industry and practitioners and researchers and the government. And so it exists in this sort of like best practice space. And in some places it's legislated and in some places it's not. I'm not saying that that is the reason and that's what needs to happen, but I do think it's a really good example of an adjustment to the system
Right.
that adds one additional layer of protection. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But could it potentially flag and catch that visitor, that tourist who had a triple bypass last year and doesn't think that that is going to be a problem when they get into the water for the first time ever, snorkeling off the back of a boat or something? So I think, I bring up that example again as an interesting systems idea, and I think that we need to be doing a little bit more of that. Not to say that, education is there's no place for education. There absolutely is. There absolutely is, and there always will be. I just think that we need to expand our scope of what's possible, think a little bit broader, and then maybe do some reflection on our education about, are we delivering this education in the best way possible?
Right. So let's move on. I remember one of the slides, which has to do with the systems, which you had water, not just about water, but you had a slide that had, I thought it was really good because it really, you've got culture, family, health, justice, infrastructure, education, development, employment, climate resistance, conservation, community. And you're right. They all have to be working together or are affected in some way if we're going to make any kind of behavior change. So you're
So
saying,
this
yeah.
Yeah, so this really, I mean, the thinking here is really about how we see ourselves as water safety people. How do we see ourselves as a drowning prevention advocate? And, historically, drowning prevention, depending on where you are, this is different depending on where you are, but in most of the US, drowning prevention has either been aligned with public health or maybe recreation. And both perspectives offer lots of value, but they're different, right? My training as a biostatistician and an epidemiologist is going to be very different than someone who has spent a career in recreation and tourism, right? Their perception on safety is going to be different than my nerd idea about risk, right? And so I think this really is about understanding that drowning is not going to be solved by one discipline alone. It's too big of an issue. It's too complex of an issue. And there's incredible value. The Hawaii Water Safety Task, the coalition meeting was a really good example of this. There's something powerful happens when you have a table and there's an ocean lifeguard, a swim teacher, someone from the health department, someone from the tourism authority, the person who's very passionate about this and is a journalist and thinking about the world in a different way,
Right.
someone from city government, someone who's a lawyer and isn't a keen surfer, right? Like when we have multiple perspectives around the table, I think is when 2 + 2 = more than 4. And so this really is about acknowledging that drowning is a multi-sectoral issue, it's a complex issue, and we should be embracing lots of different perspectives as we seek to solve this problem.
I agree with you. I mean, Alison Schaefer's, as you talked to, wrote this water safety plan. She's a journalist and she was on the show and she said, just recently, it's a public health crisis here in Hawaii. That's a pretty
Yeah,
strong
absolutely.
statement. So if it's a public health crisis, how do we all work together? Because Duane DeSoto has said, we're all in our little silos about what we'll do, right? And we're all trying to protect what we have and what we know as expertise. So we still are, we're still coming out with these messages of which you said messages probably aren't the answer. I don't know, but we still have an alarmingly high drowning rate. So how, we must be asking the questions wrong, right? We must be.
Well, I don't know if we're asking I mean, there's always going to be an element of like, are we asking the right questions? Do we have the right data? But I do think, to Duane's point about people operating in silos, the other kind of really powerful thing that we've been doing quite a bit of thinking on is this idea of reframing drowning prevention, right? And I gave some examples when I was with the group a few weeks ago, but thinking the junior lifeguard program is a pretty good example of this. Junior lifeguards without a doubt, make kids more competent in the water. It increases skills, it increases awareness. It's also really fun, right? So it's this like, it's not just a water safety or a drowning prevention initiative. It is a sport initiative. It's teaching kids how to problem solve, work together. It's a self-efficacy, mental health, physical health. It's a sun safety initiative. In many places, it's a cultural and historical and environmental initiative. Junior lifeguard program goes to a new beach and they get to learn about the traditional practices and owners of that beach. They get to learn about the fauna and the flora and the sea creatures that are, native to that beach. So I think this idea of reframing drowning prevention can be really powerful because it helps us add a dose of water safety and drowning prevention to lots of things that are already happening. And so there's plenty of opportunities for that to engage in systems that are already meeting or are already engaging with high-risk populations. Instead of creating our own new thing, instead of creating our own new message, is there a way to reframe drowning prevention into systems that are already reaching people?
Well, I agree with you. Junior lifeguards have been around for a long time. My kids went through it. It's great, but it doesn't hit all populations or people that are drowning. And a lot of kids aren't going to gravitate towards something like that because, to be honest, junior lifeguards is pretty competitive. And not every kid is going to be competitive. So I think that's great, but I don't think it's an answer to everything. So let's move on to the next thing, which is there's been a debate we've had on the Water Safety Task Force as to whether we're putting too much emphasis on swimming lessons. And should we be looking at water competence, meaning, what does that mean versus swimming as a skill? Because we know that a lot of people are drowning who are very competent at swimming. So,
Okay, so there's a few things there to tease out. I think the first one, the quote unquote debate or the discussion that you're describing is not new. For 50 plus years, people have been having this conversation of, we're not we don't need to be teaching everybody perfect butterfly and perfect freestyle. But we do need to be teaching, this sort of base level of skills and water competency, which involves things like floating and recognizing risk and being able to tread water for a certain amount of time, identifying a safe place to get in and get out, that sort of thing. It's more of like the holistic whole picture than perfect stroke technique, which is what a lot of sport focused groups focus on. So I think it is important that we try and get as many people, especially young people, to be competent in the water as possible. But there's a lot of barriers to this. One, there are places to learn in the ocean, but not all surf beaches especially are suited to teaching people these sorts of skills. So, is there an available safe place to learn? The easiest one is usually a pool. And aquatic infrastructure is very challenging to maintain. It's limited. You've got to drive a long way. You've got to pay $8 to go in. That brings this whole other thing on around, is there a barrier to entry via cost of transport, lack of a swimming suit, that sort of thing. And so, the discussion that's going on in Hawaii is the discussion that's happening in lots of places is how do we ensure population level access to learning these essential core life skills? And in my mind, I think that that's probably the one of the most, if not the most important drowning prevention sort of initiative. Would be to set a goal that every fourth grader, every third grader, in Hawaii is going to be able to be competent in the water. Every child should be able to and has the right to enjoy a lifetime of aquatic activity that brings family and health and culture and mental health and all these other wonderful things. And hopefully they'll develop the skills to get themselves out of trouble if they ever find themselves at in a tricky spot.
Well, that's well said, because if we had that commitment from the top up, we'd be doing a lot more than we are now. But that doesn't stop us from actually doing something. You know, and
Absolutely.
I've seen Nkomikai in their program, and I know George Senteo with the Department of Education, who was also at your conference at the conference, is trying to get something going in the physical education departments. I
Right.
think something's better than nothing to try. And
Of course.
what you're saying is we're doing programs, but we're not doing any research to see how effective they've been.
So this, yeah, so okay, this is my the other guilty as charged as a self-proclaimed nerd. Always going to evaluate or advocate for really robust and rigorous evaluation of these programs. And one of the things that is quite difficult is that often, if there's a program, and let's just pick big round numbers, if there's a program and there's $100,000 dedicated to a program, which is a lot of money, spending $30,000 on an evaluation with professional researchers oftentimes is kind of a hard pill to swallow, right? But if you develop robust data that then allows that $100,000 the next time an investment comes along to turn into a million or two or three, then it's definitely worth it.
Of
So
course.
I do think that we need to always be advocating for evaluation of our programs in a really strategic and pragmatic way that gets us answers, the answers we need in the time frame that we need them. Is a really important one because very often, and my research colleagues will understand this as I describe it, but very often the academic cycle is not aligned with the political and the funding cycle, right? And so if there's a pilot program that happens and you don't get results for a year and a half or 2 years, the political window to re-up that program or enhance that program might have closed. And so I think on the research side, we need to get a little bit better around realistic, pragmatic, timely evaluation that actually feeds into embedding some of these pilot programs into the system.
Well, you know Mike Tipton, right, who
Of
runs the
course.
Institute of Physiological, I think I got it right. Anyway, in Exeter, his work studying a 20-minute lesson given in the school, which he feels is important, like a life lesson, as you said, every child is, it's their right to have this information and be safe in water. That's now going to be implemented in every school in the UK based on his research. So his research was pretty symptomatic. I mean, systematic, you probably know. 20-minute lesson. They did the pre-test, which what do you know about water safety, rip currents, all that. Then they gave him the lesson. Then they asked him after the lesson. Then they asked him 3 to 6 months later. So it goes back to the systems piece. They did very well at remembering it. But that information they took home to their families then shared it. That became really important. And I don't understand why we can't do that and why you can't
So,
help us do that.
yeah, so I think that there's lots of lessons to learn from the entire cycle, not just the research cycle there, but actually the political engagement. The systems change throughout the process. That's a really, really good example of how to do things well. On the education piece, I know that we were talking about this a little earlier, but I have questions around, again, this idea that if only, I'll talk about young males, if only the young males knew, then they wouldn't have done whatever the activity is. One of the really eye-opening parts of my PhD research was working on an education program for high school kids in Australia. And I was really fortunate to go and do a bunch of focus groups with young guys, 13, 14-year-old guys, who were all sort of coastal beach rat kids. And I really dug into this idea around risk and risky behavior And all of them knew that they shouldn't go to this beach because it was unpatrolled. There was no lifeguards there. They all knew that it was dangerous to jump off the rocks. They all knew that it was dangerous to do, to go out and surf, but they all did it anyway. And they were saying that to my face. They were saying, "Oh, we know, but we're going to do it anyway," which really underscores this. I think this, again, this trap that we might be falling into, that knowledge is the answer. And there's some emerging research from Australia that's really showing the power of normative engagement. And what I mean by normative engagement is an engagement, an education session that isn't focused on one-way transmission of knowledge. So I'm going to give you information about a rip current. You're going to accept it. You're going to have knowledge and awareness, and then you're going to change behavior. A normative engagement process is really more about a meaningful experience that causes reflection and a change in the way the person sees themselves and their relationship to the risk. So that is way more of a two-way interaction. And in this pilot study in Australia, they had lifeguards, they had lifesavers who were doing 20-minute, they were trained to do this in a specific way, 20-minute sessions on the beach that asks lots of open-ended questions. It's really about the experience, and it's about getting people to adopt, like a new DNA when they go to the beach,
Right.
right? And they're showing that this sort of normative engagement is actually a much more powerful driver of behavior change than just awareness only. So I think that there's lots of opportunities to tweak and adjust the things that we're doing now in the education space to be a more active, reflective, experiential process, which, again, emerging research, emerging evidence is showing us is a little bit of a stronger predictor and driver of behavior change.
Yeah, I would not suggest that somebody goes in and gives them information in some dry form that nobody gets to talk about, because I think you're right. We had Bruce Hopkins out here for a rip current clinic, which turned out to be a good thing. We only had it was just done like pretty quick when Kalani had the Okinawan lifeguards, and we had it in Hanalei, and people that went through it felt like they really got something out of that. People really wanted to understand, if they got it, one, what it was like. And Rob was saying, not all rip currents are going to take you straight out. So if you know that they're recirculating within the surf zone, you can understand how it's going to feel. So the experience, I think, is important for changing people's behavior on how they're going to act. Second,
Okay.
let me finish and then you can go on. Kainamakua came on and talked about, if he was going to do anything about messaging, it would be a cultural piece. And when he was at a conference for Native Americans, he realized that they haven't had any new ceremonies in a very long time. And maybe it was time to create a new ceremony around water safety. So that's what I'm talking about, because in Hawaii, culture is really a big piece. We're missing out on that. That has not been translated. And so I look at the piece going into the schools as a much more creative piece. And Nakama Kai's been willing and has been giving kind of lessons culturally and in the ocean along with what they're doing. So I think we should start somewhere, because if we don't have it there, then it means it's not that important.
Margaret, what you just described though was a textbook reframe of drowning prevention, right? Like you and I are having this conversation about water safety, and a colleague there that you described said, "Oh, I think actually this is a cultural issue, and we
Right,
should be
Kainamakua.
communicating." We should be communicating this, not as a water safety thing, but as a traditional cultural practice. That's a reframe, right? And I think that the more that we can do that, the more successful we will be. I did just want to bring up like one, I just want to throw one wrench in the machine in the
Okay,
conversation
go
we're
ahead.
having.
I'm ready.
What you know, when you look at in Hawaii specifically, what is in the nexus of control? Education messaging, school-based education, water competency for every third grader. Again, really important, very, very, very critical, but not going to address the tourist problem,
That's
right?
correct. We need to go with the tourist problem now.
Teaching
Let's
every
try.
fourth grader to swim is great, but you have this other like half of the pop of your drowning
Okay, so let's
population that
talk
you
about
know.
these visitors. You tell me
Okay.
how we're going to change their behavior, or at least make them aware. Nobody likes to be told what to do. This is
No,
correct.
of course. Of course. No one likes to be told what to do. I think
It's a cultural piece.
the biggest, I think, look, the Hawaiian lifeguards do a really amazing job at preventing these incidents from happening seconds before they occur, from rescuing people when they get into trouble. And so I think that the support for the lifeguards is sort of the last line of defense, is super, super important. So if there are hot spots or black spots, which the Hawaii Water Safety Plan has identified a few, and those places are not lifeguarded, I think advocating for lifeguard services to be in those locations, especially during the times when visitors are at these places, should be a huge priority. If you think on the timeline, just one step up, I think that the most efficient opportunities are going to be engaging in the systems and the places where tourists are already involved. So that would be partnering with the hotels, which I know that there's been a bit of work in that space, partnering with all the parts of the tourist experience from when you book your ticket, and Instagram immediately starts feeding people information on an additional zip line or an additional turtle tour or something to do. We should be engaging in that tourist journey from the second someone starts thinking about visiting the islands, all the way to when they go home, and probably beyond, so they can help spread that message. So again, I think partnering in and thinking really critically about reaching tourists in places where they are already engaging is going to offer more bang for buck than creating something new, some new program, some new message, et cetera.
Well, we had talked about this with Kalani, and we were talking at the airport here in Kauai. We do have messaging. Nobody listens to it. I mean, people think they do, but they're getting their bags and they want to get out. But there's a lot of advertising for zip line tours, and I thought, well, why don't we have rip current clinics or some other thing that people pay, they get involved and they learn something interesting about the ocean and how to stay safe. Right? We should.
Which I think that there's plenty of opportunities to do, right? Like
Right.
people go on a snorkeling tour, and there's wonderful opportunities for engagement of not only about safety, but also about conservation, also about sun safety, about all these other issues. And I think that a lot of the tourist operators do
Yes.
that sort of thing. I'm just curious, and I don't know the answer to this. I would just be curious about how consistent those are. Is it happening on every boat? Is there some best practice? Are there some resources
There's
that are
some research
provided?
there. There's some research
Yeah,
there, Will.
maybe that's a really great question, but I think even that might be an opportunity where even just a little dose of alignment and consistency could have a really important
Yes,
impact.
consistency. So if we're talking about snorkeling, and I had Ralph Goto on here, and he was involved in a study with Dr. Foti. And that was a great study, and a lot of information came out. And there's a couple where he drowned, and she is suing the Hawaii Tourism Authority because she felt like the information that was in that study about rapid onset pulmonary embolism
Edema.
was not given to them to say, well, we're not sure, but maybe you should wait 24, 48 hours. And so they're saying we'd rather have the information and make our own decision about what we're going to do than not have the information. And I think that's a very important piece. I think you just give people information, they can do with what they want with it. But in this case, we're having snorkeling deaths and drownings and non-fatal ones by tourists lead the way in that area. And it's perplexing, actually. And
Yeah.
Hanama Bay, which is an area we talked about, Ralph and I talked about the week before, two people died, drowned,
Yeah, it's
right?
awful.
So he said, well, we need more research. And I go, well, how about just a pilot study right there in Hanama Bay and find out what's going on? But something, because I'm not always sure that more research is what we need. There's Hannah Van Wart. Do you know her? In she was saying that she was worked on a big piece of research, and her pushback to me was, I think we have research that says that we need to look at the manufacturers of the snorkeling gear to make them responsible. It's a breathing apparatus, not a toy. And so that was just a comeback to that, and it's kind of a little off. But what do you say to doing a pilot piece of research or on snorkeling here, maybe at home?
So, I mean, what the situation that you're describing, the word that comes to mind as I hear you describing this moment, right, that we're in is complicated. Like, this is pretty complicated. And there's some legitimate research and data questions here. There's some legitimate concerns, probably from industry, people who are selling these things. There's some legitimate concerns from the lifeguards and the water safety community. And so, I can see the complex nature of this, and it really underscores, I think, the need for a few different things. One, continued collaboration on the issue, because this is a spot where people are at risk of saying, I know the answer, I'm just going to blast down this path on my own, and everybody else can follow me. So I think, really thinking critically about getting people around the table to try and figure out the best path forward is one. Two, you've mentioned, this is actually an area where probably additional research really is needed, to help guide and help us understand a little bit more about the problem in order to guide and really figure out what's needed most. And finally, I mean, I think too, like, this really is an area where different sectors are going to approach the problem quite differently, which kind of reinforces this collaboration point. So again, I think that this is obviously a very, very important issue in the islands. Research is probably needed, but equally is just trying to get people to continue moving together on this.
Well, yeah, there's Laura Trapani did some work in Italy and with kids on that ended up in the emergency room. She's an emergency room physician. And her it was just with a couple of kids. And what they realized is that most of these full face masks say do not use for any child under the age of 5. But what she's saying is it should be saying after a certain weight of a child, like a car seat, right? And the Italian ministry got hold of that, and they're preparing documents to the manufacturers of full face masks to get things to change. Now, that wasn't a major big piece of research, but it was enough to get people to think about it. And what she was saying has to do with lung capacity and everything else, and the ability and how much CO2 goes in. So
Yeah,
I
this,
thought
I
that
mean,
was really good.
it is like this, it's an interesting example of how to get stuff done, which I think
Right.
is another kind of important lesson, is
Yes.
oftentimes we can get, like, get stuck in navel gazing and just chatting the whole time. So it is important to continue to get stuff done. But also, this is a really technical issue.
Right.
Like, you were talking about, look, I know nothing about lung capacity and the physiology of alveoli exchange and all these big fancy words. And here you and I are talking about it, right? So I think it also is really important just to understand that, like, the complex technical nature of this means that it's pretty important that we get it right.
So, What are you going to do for us in Hawaii? Are you going to do some focus groups, or are you coming over here to Kauai? Well, what's going to
Well,
happen here?
I would love to come back. I
And
had such a
measurable
wonderful time.
objectives here. I mean, you talked about, decreasing rates of drowning. Have you proposed anything that says we should say by the year 2030, we should have, decreased the drowning rates among tourists
So
by
yeah, so look, I will acknowledge and recognize that I don't think actually that that's my place. I think that that really is kind of a strategic decision of you, actually, of the people that
Right.
live on the island or are responsible for these issues, but also really passionate about making a difference. And one of the things that I chatted about in my talk at the Hawaii Water Safety Coalition was this idea of setting a goal and a target.
Right.
And the obvious reason that you set a goal and a target is that you want to meet it. But there's lots of other reasons to set a goal and a target. And one of the really powerful reasons to do that is to get lots of people moving in the same direction and really fired up and excited about, making a difference. So here in Australia, we set the target of a 50% reduction in drowning rate over 10 years. And even though we're about halfway through our 10-year strategy and the rates are not going in the right direction, that unifying goal, that target has really provided the bond for a lot of different people in the space to band together and say, if we're going to make this happen, we need to do something big, meaningful. We need to really lean in here and work together on this. And I do kind of imagine a different world where if we didn't have that 50% reduction target, it would allow people to continue to just flitter through life
Right.
without really banding together.
That's
And
right.
so I do think that there's some value there, but that's got to be up to you. That's got to be up to
Well,
you.
I know, but I want to hear more about Australia. So you have a strategic plan there, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, so the Australian Water Safety Strategy is actually in its sixth rendition. The first national water safety plan came out in 1998, and so there's a lot of history and lessons learned from over 25 years of doing this work, and in the most recent version of the strategy. We have some focus areas. So, for example, the older adult drowning rate in Australia is increasing. So, we've named older adults as a population of focus. Inland waterways are a real challenge in Australia. Like beaches, there's a lot of incidents that happen at beaches, but the surf lifesaving culture here is very, very strong. And there's lots of coastal safety work that's happening. There's very little that happens on inland waterways, rivers, lakes, and dams. And actually, rivers are the leading location for drowning in Australia. And so we've named tackling drowning at rivers is a really important thing. So there's some focus areas that help us kind of guide the sector broadly defined towards focusing on the people and the places and the issues where we are likely to make a big difference if we're successful. And then finally, we have, as part of our framework, we've identified three national imperatives. The first one is water safety and swimming skills for all, which is back kind of to this water competence question that we were having earlier. But
Yes.
I think the most important part of that whole thing are the words for all.
Yes.
And that really has got us to think about what does it mean for everyone to have the opportunity to learn how to swim. So there's some interesting things that happen there.
So that came
The
out in the
second,
plan. Let me just back up. So
yes,
who
yes.
is behind the water safety and swimming for all? Who?
So, okay, you're bringing up a very important lesson that the Australian community has learned. Again, I'm not Australian, but I live in Australia and I live, eat, and breathe the water safety strategy. My understanding is that 15 or 20 years ago, when they were first getting going on this stuff, they created like a spreadsheet and they said, okay, water safety for all, who's going to tackle it? this group. Who's going to tackle this one? This group, this one. And it sort of fell apart, right? Because they're in reality, the strategy is a document of cohesion and influence.
Right.
A strategy is different than a plan. A strategy is to choose the areas where you focus, is to choose the fields that you're going to play on. A plan is a point by point how you're going to win, right? And when in the current environment, in the ecosystem that is here, actually, and in many, many other places, when you have a plan with point by point, here's how you're going to win, and no mechanism of funding or control or power, it sort of falls apart.
Right.
And so in a network space, and that's what the Australian Water Safety Council is. It's a network. It's a bunch of organizations who are all signed up to this goal of reducing drowning by 50% by 2030. But all of them operate independently. Everybody has their own, sources of funding, their own priorities, their own board of directors. Everybody's got certain interests and goals. And so the strategy is sort of like the loose thread that binds everyone together and kind of helps us move in a similar direction. And so one of the lessons from the early 2000s was actually, we're not going to assign water safety to all to a certain group. We're not going to assign river safety to a certain group. We're going to encourage people to be inspired and align their current work to these big picture priorities. And in many places that's worked really well. In others, it hasn't worked as well as we would have liked. And there's a variety of reasons for that. Some are within our control and most of them aren't. But one of the really successful examples from Australia is actually the child drowning rate, right? Like since 2002, the child drowning rate, this is under fives, has decreased by 64%, right? When you look at the graph, it's like this mountain that just goes down, which is remarkable.
So,
And that was not due to one group. That was due to lots of different groups pushing towards the same thing. And that had to do with pool, swimming pool fencing legislation. It had to do with educating parents around the importance of supervising your kids around the water. It had to do with campaigns like Keep Watch Around Water, watch your kids. It had to do with early water familiarization classes, which are like mom and bub swimming lessons kind of things. And so it's like this suite, it's this package, it's this collection of lots of different groups doing lots of different things, but all dedicated towards reducing child drowning. And they've been really successful.
and so you've done research to back that up?
So there's actually one of the very original studies on swimming pool fencing legislation is called the Brisbane Drowning Study. Professor John Pern runs that study, and Professor Pern actually did a study in Honolulu years and years and years ago. I'll send that one to you on child drowning. And so there's evidence, there's real good evidence that says, when in Brisbane and Queensland, when they instituted swimming pool fencing legislation, the childhood drowning rate decreased. And overall, we came out with a paper about 5 years ago that looked at the long-term trends of drowning. A colleague of mine, Lauren Miller, did that study. And this is where we found a statistically significant decrease over time in these various areas of the water safety strategy, and which we believe is largely due to collaborative efforts and a lot of different activities happening, moving in the same space, happening at the same time from a bunch of different organizations.
So moving in the same space at the same time, it's a
Towards
public
the
health.
same, towards the same target. Towards the
Yes.
same target. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a public health crisis, so I always think it should start at the top. We should have
Yeah.
acknowledgement from the
Yeah.
top. It should be a state priority.
So, there's no, I will say this, there's no other state, as far as I'm aware, that gets the governor to show up to their Water Safety Coalition meeting.
Right.
I think the acknowledgement from the governor and from the mayor in Kauai and other leaders in this space, this is an important issue, and you do have that acknowledgement. I think the interesting question now is what next, and how do you implement change, or how do you motivate How do you motivate systems to be adjusted to make a real difference?
I was hoping you'd answer that, Will.
Oh no. It's my job to
Just
inspire
kidding.
you to answer it.
I think it's great you're doing research, but people want to do more research, but it's been a year and I'm getting impatient about how we can solve these problems because it seems like every week we're having
So
a
I think there's
non-fatal
a
drowning.
yes. So
A
there's a really
raccoon.
interesting question that happens here, which is, what are you passionate about? What do you want to do? What part of the drowning problem do you want to tackle?
Well, I'm doing this show because I think more people should understand evidence-based research so they can make more informed decisions and amplify the message that drowning is preventable. And it's a global issue. So if we could collaborate and work with people around the world, maybe we'd help solve our problems better, or maybe we'd help solve their problems better.
The issue 7.1 in the Hawaii Water Safety Plan is collaborating across our island state,
Correct,
and
right?
you're doing it. You're doing it. And then the second kind of important piece for this, Maria, is, are you having fun?
Of course I'm having fun with it. I
Yeah,
get
of
to
course
talk
you
to
are.
you.
Look at you.
I can't
Yeah,
have beer.
you're having a blast. You're
I
having a
can't
blast.
have
And so,
beer and wings with you, Dr. Kuhn, but that's okay.
next time, next time. So, I do think, for people listening, I think it's important to remember that, this work can be really dark, actually. And it can be really serious. Like, we are talking about tragedy. And so you gotta pick a slice of the pie to dedicate your time and your energy to. And it should align with not only your skills, but your interests. And you should be doing it with other people that you like spending time with and that you should be passionate about. And Margaret, you've nailed it. Like, look at you. You're doing a great show. You're talking with loads of people. You're obviously having fun, maybe too much fun. And you're really helping people understand a bigger picture of drowning across the islands. You're bringing in lots of new voices. You're generating and stirring up a conversation. And so I think this is a really good, it's a really good example of that hopefully inspires others to think about, what is the drowning or the water safety problem in your neighborhood, at your local beach? And is there something that you're really passionate about that you can lean into and try and solve? Even if you solve just a slice of the problem, that is a meaningful difference in somebody's life. Saving one life is one
Correct.
additional life
That's
that
correct.
could have been lost.
Yes. But one other question I have for you. I don't know if you can answer it, but you did say that you're working on helping us collect better data so we'll have better information. And that's exciting, as you said in the beginning of this talk. Can you say anything about that? I know you're part of the CDC Foundation and with Tessa Clemens. And I got
Very
on that
exciting
webinar,
work.
which was very interesting about Alaska and what they were doing. So.
Yes, so very, very exciting work. The CDC Foundation, and this is all public knowledge now, the CDC Foundation is partnering and doing some work in Hawaii, and a big part of that work is going to be looking at data and strengthening the data systems and doing a bit of research in collaboration with the Department of Public Health. So hopefully that will really provide new information that's informative to prevention efforts and the system that tries to prevent drowning across the islands.
So, if education isn't the answer to change behavior, what is it, Dr. Kuhn, to change
So
behavior?
okay, so let's rephrase.
Because we could
Education
talk about smoking.
alone.
People smoked forever and they knew all the things.
And what got them to change?
Finally, when it was, actually the research came out and said it causes cancer, and it was a big
So
thing. Up to
I
that point.
love this example. It's one of my favorite. It's
Okay.
like the best public health story is that
Okay.
people knew smoking was bad. Then this research came out that said smoking causes cancer, and the rates didn't really change that much.
Right.
When rates started to change is when public health professionals started to come out with ads that said smoking is going to cause your teeth to fall out, and no one wants to kiss a smoker, and smokers smell bad and they're ugly.
Well, there you go. There's a different
Right?
message. So, what
That, so, so,
message?
but okay, but that's not awareness, right? That is influencing attitudes. It's influencing your perception of yourself. It's
Correct.
influencing someone, the way that someone thinks about themselves and the activity. It's not just saying cancer's bad. So here's what we learned. Here's what we learned in a little bit from some of my research in Australia is we were telling high school kids, hey, don't jump off that rock at low tide. It's really dangerous. They were all coming back and saying, we know, we like doing it, right?
Right.
And so we really dug into them about what is really important in your life. What are your values? How do you see yourself? How do you see your relationship with the water? And one of the things that came out really, really strongly was they really cared deeply for their friends. And so we switched the whole message about in this specific location from kids telling kids, don't go jump off the rock, to, hey, be a good mate.
Right.
Don't watch out for your friends. And it was a peer pressure conversation. It was really aimed at their values as being a good mate, being a good friend. And good friends don't pressure their other friends to jump off rocks. And so we co-developed this with a bunch of 13 or 14-year-olds, and they said, yep, this if I saw this campaign, this would make me think twice about jumping off that rocks or telling Jimmy that, he's a wuss and he needs to jump off too, right? So that again, a very different message, be a good friend versus don't jump off the rock because it's dangerous,
Right,
right?
because one's a warning, one is giving a whole different
Real,
message about you.
and it's and again, it's aimed at values, it's aimed at,
Yep.
the way that you see yourself. And so I think there's lots of opportunities to enhance our education messages in that space.
Well, that's good. And maybe we should be doing that here, obviously, with some focus groups and different targets of group, because I think that's exactly what's needed. Everything we're doing now isn't making a difference. And for tourists, maybe that's something very different we do too. I don't know. Do you have any recommendations for the tourist group here, the visitors?
Oh no. I mean, I like I, but this is a partly personally, this is partly why I
That's
really
okay.
like working in water safety.
Right.
Because we're looking at a situation where there's been a lot of thinking and a lot of work, but this is very different than road traffic accidents. If I had dedicated myself to road traffic accidents, there's a lot of science there. There's loads of people working in the space. And same thing
Right.
with cancer or malaria or any of these other issues. Drowning is partly really interesting because there's so much opportunity to test new things and try new things and really evaluate our efforts to see if we're making a difference.
It's a growing field, for sure.
Absolutely it is.
Yeah,
Absolutely it
now
is.
you can get degrees in drowning prevention or something like that. Is that
It's
correct?
wild. I mean, yeah. I mean, hey, I like there seems like there's a new PhD focused on drowning prevention in Australia like every year, every other year, which is awesome. I mean, it's a growing field and people are really passionate. One of the other things that I love about this space and you and your listeners who are interested in the topic would know is that people are really, really passionate about this issue. And when I get tired or a little burned out and kind of frustrated with stuff, it's people like Jesse and Allison
Yep.
actually that light my fire again and say, man, this is such an important issue, and the passion that so many of these people have is really inspiring and keeps me going, definitely.
Well, thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say to anyone who's listening? Because people listen from around the world, but they go travel to Australia and everywhere. They're not just here on Hawaii.
Oh, I would just say thank you for the opportunity to chat. I do think it's really important that we continue to promote the wonderful benefits of being in, on, and around the water,
Yeah.
and not just try and be the fun police.
Right.
Like,
Exactly.
our goal here should be that every kid should learn how to swim because one, swimming is awesome, and two, it opens so many doors I mean, it's opened so many doors for me. The water is still my safe place. It's my happy place. It's where I exercise. I swim laps at lunch if I can. I go to the beach most days. It has really grounded me. It's a core part of my marriage. It's where I go. It's where I go with my dog. And none of that would be possible if I didn't learn how to swim as a kid and wasn't comfortable with water. And so, it's really important that I think we not only focus on the prevention side, but really focus on the benefits of being in on and around the water.
Correct. Dr. Mayor Kawakami said we should get more people in the water. A lot of our legislators should get in the water. It would be very healing to them.
It would be
They
very healing. Yeah,
understand.
put them in a rip.
Well, it's been delightful to talk to you. I'm going to end this conversation and have a wonderful trip to Japan. And
Thank you so
I want
much.
to hear some more from you. Are you going to be doing anything more with the Hawaii Lifeguard Association in the future, do you think?
I really, really hope to. You've got such wonderful people doing really important work. I really hope to kind of stay plugged in, and I'm always a resource. If I can be helpful, I'm always a phone call away, and really happy to continue supporting in any way that I can.
Thank you very much. I'm going to end this. Dr. Will Kuhn reminds us that drowning prevention is more than about swimming or warning signs. It starts with understanding who is drowning, under what circumstances, and whether our prevention efforts are reaching the people who need them most. One of the key themes from today's conversation is that not all drowning incidents are the same. Visitors, residents, children, older adults, snorkelers, surfers, paddlers, fishermen face different risks and may require different prevention strategies. If Hawaii is serious about reducing drowning, we need to continue asking better questions, collecting better data, and investing in solutions that are based on evidence. So thank you, Dr. Kuhn, Will, for sharing your research and your insights today. I'd talk to you forever because you have done a lot of really great stuff. And I've had Rob Brander and Jazz on the show, and they're both great people and are doing great work. And it's been insightful for here because they've taken a listen to that information that they may not have had before. And the water safety plan, as you said, has to be a living document. You have to be able to use it or it just sits on a shelf, right? So,
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. Looking forward to the next time we get to chat.
okay. Thanks, Will. Have a good trip.